My story begins, as most of our stories do, before I began. My mother and father met and fell in love because they were in a band together. But before you get excited, it was a Christian band. My father was the guitar player and my mother was the singer. They were very devout Christians and they got married so they could have sex. My mother was this white French woman and my father was a black and Native American man. But it was the early 70s, so all anybody really saw was a black man and a white woman. When they started dating, my mother was threatened with disownment, and that threat was carried through when they got married. My mother very quickly found herself pregnant, and just as quickly found herself left, separated, single. So now, my mother was an unmarried white woman, pregnant with a mixed-race baby and disowned from her family at 19. She has confessed to me many times how she felt so bad for not wanting me, for never wanting me. How once I was born, she wanted me, but for those 10 months that I brewed inside, she wished I had never existed. I can imagine that it was probably just impossible for her not to focus so much resentment on this unborn thing that had caused her so much loss. And so in a trauma that predates language, it even predates my birth, I was born imbued with a guilt at being born, a guilt at existing.
I'm Gregory Day. You're listening to the Portland Podcast. We're back for 2025 and have a brand new season in store for you. At the top of the show, you heard an excerpt from Alex Kennedy's audio biography featured on her podcast, The Devil Made Me Do It. Alex's show explores her unconventional pathway to sobriety in the hopes that it can inspire others to do the same. The bulk of today's show is lifted from part one of Alex's episode titled Break My Rusted Chains, with additional production added by yours truly. You're welcome. I'll provide a link to part two of Alex's story in the show notes. In the meantime, enjoy the rust.
According to my mother, once I was born, I was so adorable that my grandparents forgave her transgressions and allowed her back into the fold. I have a feeling it was probably a lot more than that, but I'll take the compliment where I can get it. Instead of focusing her energy and actions on changing the racist and conditional acceptance that she was raised in, she instead focused all of her energy into eradicating anything that might let anybody else know that I was part black, including giving me a name that was purposefully given to me in order to make me seem more white. I remember once what my 10-year-old brain thought was a joke, a lighthearted comment, and I jokingly said, "Who names a little black girl beep anyway?" And she grabbed me by my hair and pulled the back of my head and said through gritted teeth, "You are not black." So I didn't joke about it anymore. But around that same time, I did refuse to continue going by that name. I unofficially changed my name to the name of the protagonist in all of the stories that I wrote. Back then, I was really into writing spy stories, hugely inspired by Ian Fleming, and my protagonist, Alex, always figured everything out. My super fine hair was soaked in lye to straighten it, burning my scalp, and I was devoid of all culture, with the exception of performative or visual Native American parts of my culture. But when it came to my Black culture, I was not only denied it, but I was punished for it. By age 7, my mother had remarried a white man, and I soon had 2 younger brothers. Now, my mother changed her last name when she got married, which is pretty common. However, my last name wasn't changed. So now in my family of 4, I was not only the only one who was brown, I was the only one with a different last name. And that really drove home the message that I was getting every day anyway. And that was that I was, and I would always be, an outsider, an other, and not just any other, but an unwanted other, one that was a reminder of something bad, of an embarrassment. So even though he was at that time my second stepfather, my mother had been married 3 times by that point, he was really the only person that I've ever considered a dad. He was always really kind to me. He was a really good dad, treated me like I was his own child. So of course, that couldn't last. They were divorced by the time I was 11. And after a short while of my single mother trying to get by with 3 kids, my stepdad took full custody of my 2 brothers, and it was back to just being me and my mom. So around that time, around 11, that's when I started drinking, smoking cigarettes, smoking pot. You know, it was the 80s. It was really easy to get cigarettes. I could actually, for real, purchase them from this little mom-and-pop market down the street. They just had a rule that you had to have a note from your parents. So I would routinely, at age 11, forge letters from my mother saying, please allow my daughter to purchase this pack of cigarettes for me, and then to throw them off, to make sure they wouldn't think it was me who wrote it, I would always make sure that I would buy some candy as well. In this, like, I'm just a innocent little child, see, as evidenced by this candy I'm purchasing. It worked. Either it worked, or they really just didn't care. Alcohol was also extremely easy to come by, since all of my friends' parents kept alcohol in the house. Around age 13 was when my alcohol and weed use became an every weekend ritual. And that was because every weekend, I would spend the night at my best friend's house. Her parents worked graveyard shift, and she had a younger brother who was about 6 that we were responsible for babysitting. So every Friday night, her parents left for their graveyard shift, and they would leave us with a bag of weed. We'd stay up all night smoking pot and watching weird after-hours cable shows. Or when we'd get really high, we'd listen to Stevie Nicks or the Hotel California album and talk about our magical psychic abilities. On special occasions, like New Year's Eve, when her parents would be out until the next morning, they would leave booze as well. In fact, my first memories of being horribly sick from the combination of weed and booze are from those babysitting weekends. I have this one a very distinct memory of a night when her parents attempted to leave without leaving us our bag of weed. We freaked out. I can still recall that weird feeling of panic that I felt when I realized that we were going to be left sober all night. Panic. We began acting like the children that we were, begging her dad to leave us weed. Her dad, who was getting more and more pissed off, especially after my friend, in obvious desperation, threw herself to the ground as he attempted to walk out the door and wrapped her arms around his legs. He was so pissed, he was actually trying to kick her free from his legs. Finally, he reached into his pocket, pulled out a Ziploc bag of weed, threw it at her, and said, "Here, you fucking brats." But I'll never forget that feeling of panic. It is a feeling deeply known to addicts. Around that time, I spent as much time high as possible, and I was hanging out with a really bad crowd. Most days, I would just pretend to go to school, but instead, I would go to one of the well-known party houses where the parents were either MIA or they were too loaded themselves to care. Kids gathered, hung out, did drugs, had sex, listened to a lot of Black Sabbath in dark rooms with glowing velvet posters. But I never fit in with that group. I was too smart and sensitive for the burnouts and too weird and gothic for the preppies. Fortunately, we moved at the end of that year away from one boyfriend and in with another and into a new school district, which meant a new school, where I fit right in with the weirdos and the waivers. My home life, however, was excruciating, and I did everything I could to not be at home. In fact, it was the only year of my life when I had had perfect attendance out of fear of staying home, where my mother's boyfriend would be. He was a worse racist than she was. It was a relief being gone at school all day, but it still meant that I had to be home at night to hear the screaming fights where she was routinely called a nigger lover. I also had to sneak to watch The Cosby Show, as nigger TV was not allowed in the home. This was around the time that I first began having serious suicidal thoughts. I had no role models. I had no mentors. I had no adult in my life that I could turn to seek comfort or safety or knowledge from. My mother was solely and only interested in her boyfriend. She had zero concern or even interest in me, except where it benefited her. Making me her personal spy, for example. She made me memorize her boyfriend's license plate number so I could tell her and report back if I ever saw his car. And by the way, 30 years later, I still have that number memorized. Fortunately, again, the relationship dissolved, which meant that we were forced to move just in time for me to begin high school. It was 1986, I think, and our high school had a smoking section. It's so crazy to think about now that a high school would have a smoking section, but we did. And that's where, obviously, all the cool kids hung out before school. It was a sacred, covered area on campus that was just a plume of clove smoke and cigarette smoke and people doing hits of Rush, which was this really popular drug in the 80s and very easy to attain because you could just go to the adult bookstore at the bus mall and buy it. Amyl nitrate, they call it. So it was there, hanging out in the smoking section at school, doing Rush, smoking cloves, listening to Susie and the Banshees on somebody's boombox, where I met Nathan, my first big true love crush person. And, as an aside, for those of you listening who are hip to 90s Northwest punk scene, Nathan also went on to become the bass player for Snowbud and the Flower People. But in 1986, he was just Nathan, the school acid dealer, and by far the coolest kid in school. He was an emancipated minor, so even though he was a high school junior, he had his own apartment, he had his own car. He's the one who took me to Portland and to the city nightclub for the first time. The city nightclub was a famed and only underage gay nightclub. It was open until 4 in the morning, and it was truly an oasis for all of us unwanted kids. It was then, amidst the smell of weed and beer and vomit, drag queens, goth kids, a lot of acid, and a lot of love, that I knew I had finally found my place. And it was as far away from my mother and Vancouver, or Vantucky as we called it, as possible. From then on, my life was all about going to Portland every chance I got, and I became a major club kid. It was at the City Nightclub where I was first offered crystal methadrine. A crystal was a hugely popular club drug back before the whole Faces of Meth campaign. I will never forget the first time I did crystal meth. It was as though all the dark sludge and emptiness and shame at being alive left the building, and there was this dance party there instead. I remember thinking, oh, this is how I want to feel, you know, as though up until then I had simply not found the correct feeling, and that was the problem. I was immediately hooked. I began a weekly ritual of stealing checks from my mother, writing them for $20 over so I could buy a quarter of crystal on my way to the club. This went on for about a year. Then one day, my mom asked me if I could get her any speed. At first, I wasn't sure if it was some kind of setup or something. And then I realized the likelihood of her actually giving a shit about me or my welfare enough to set up an intervention? No. She didn't care what I was doing, where I was going all night, what danger I was constantly putting myself in. No. She wanted to lose weight. And could I please get some drugs for her? I was 17 at the time. A year earlier, I had attempted suicide. I had slit my wrists very deeply. And instead of the hospital keeping me like they should have, instead, they just sewed me up, gave me some opera glove bandages from my wrist to my elbows, and sent me home. With my mother and stepfather number 4, I think it was by then, nobody even talked to me on the way home. And I remember when we got home, I just asked if I could go out dancing that night. My mom just kind of waved me off, said sure. And that was when I just had to stop hoping. And then I met Bunny. Bunny was given that nickname not because he loved rabbits, as one might think, but because he shared a certain characteristic that rabbits also have. He also sold crystal. And in the worst possible decision one could make, he became my boyfriend, and then my live-in boyfriend. Because, you see, my mother had been forced into a domestic violence shelter after a domestic violence situation led to my mother's husband being arrested and his mother threatening to murder me. And this was a threat that we took very seriously, because not only did she live closer to us than the police could get to us, but she also was an ex-con who had been in prison for attempted murder, in which she locked her husband in the garage and set the house on fire. So it was not really what you would call an empty threat when she called and left the message on our voicemail, "You can't protect that nigger girl, I'm coming to kill her." So I left home. I moved in with my drug-dealing club king boyfriend, Bunny. Now, living with your dealer has its upsides and its downside. My drug use very quickly became an almost everyday habit. And because he made all of his money selling drugs at clubs, we spent all of our time in clubs. So I was high and drunk a good 5 out of the 7 days of the week. And I still wasn't even 18 yet. Needing my own money, I got a job at a local big box grocery store. And my drug use went back to being limited to nights that we went out dancing. He was incredibly abusive and horrible, and I was having a really hard time getting away from him. Finally, after having him arrested for the 3rd or 4th time, I filed a restraining order, and for the first time in my life, I found myself free and living alone, which was great. I made some really great friends, I had a fake ID, I was happy, I had purpose. So I completely stopped using drugs, with the exception of smoking pot, and I was only drinking, but I was drinking a lot. Then one day, I almost died. I didn't know what was wrong with me. I was just really, really sick. I was fainting. I was blacking out. My eyes were bloodshot. It became like this game where I'd say, here, press on my hand, and you would just press a little bit, and then there would instantly be a bruise there. This was in 1990. It was the height of the AIDS epidemic. This was during a time when we still didn't know how people got AIDS. People still thought you could get AIDS from the dentist. And I had done a lot of really reckless, dangerous things. And because I was so scared, I tried to avoid the whole thing. Until one night it became clear that I needed to go to the hospital, and I needed to go immediately. The only problem was I was blacking out. I was passing out, so I couldn't drive myself to the hospital. I called my mother. I told her what was happening. I asked her if she could please drive me to the hospital. She said no. She didn't want to drive at night. I could just drive myself. And when I explained the reason why I couldn't, I was blacking out, she hung up on me. So I called a coworker who lived a city away, but who was kind enough to drive in and take me to the hospital, where I was immediately admitted and then given 2 emergency blood transfusions, as well as a super not fun spinal tap. I was kept in the hospital for 2 weeks. I had idiopathic thrombocyte, which is an autoimmune disorder. Idiopathic just means we don't know. Basically, my platelets were just leaving the building. They were just leaving. Platelets, if you don't know, are what holds your blood together. So I was dying quickly. They said what would have happened if I hadn't have come in was I would have passed out, started sweating blood, and then bled to death. Knowing now what I know about trauma and how it causes these autoimmune reactions where the body attacks itself, it makes so much sense that that happened when it did. Looking back on it now, it's almost like my body was trying to commit suicide because I had failed. Once I was healed, once I was complete with my steroid schedule and my blood tests were coming back normal, I immediately started drinking again, much more heavily than before. I think when you feel like your mother leaves you for dead, it tends to get to you. At that point, it seemed like I just kept being reminded at every turn how invaluable and worthless I was. And the proof just kept punching me in the face, it seemed. So it went on this way, me drinking heavily, but still managing to hold down a job, barely, until I turned 21. I had just been heartbroken by some guy or whatever, and really I had just reached my limit. I just needed to escape. I needed to run away. Drinking was only letting me escape so much. I needed to physically leave. And it was then that I saw that fateful ad that read, "Dancers needed in Alaska, round-trip airfare and accommodations provided." It was an ad for strippers in Alaska. Now, I had never been a stripper. I had never known any strippers. I had never been in a strip club. I had never seen movies about strippers. In fact, I didn't know anything about strippers except they existed and they probably took their clothes off. But what I saw in that ad was my ticket to completely escape my life. This was before the internet and computers and stuff, so I had to write a letter. I had to send in a photo through the mail. And by the way, it was a nice, classy photo of me in a bikini. Just because I was drinking a lot doesn't mean I would ever send naked photos of myself to somebody in the mail. And via snail mail, they told me this. Here's the deal. We fly you up. You stay here. You live in dancer housing for 3 months. Once you finish your contract, we fly you back home. And I thought, what could be better than this? So that's exactly what I did. I was really excited. And for some reason, my mother got really excited about this too and was like really into helping me. She gave me a bunch of her old high heels and was trying to help me come up with a stage name and put costumes together. It was just super weird for a mom to do, in my opinion, as a mother. I put in a leave of absence at my job and had someone stay at my home and watch my cats. And still, without ever going into a strip bar or even talking to a stripper, I got on a plane, and the first time that I set foot in a strip bar was the night before my first shift. I had made an agreement with myself that I was not going to drink, I was not going to be under the influence of anything at all whatsoever the first few times that I danced, because I didn't want to have to rely on being drunk in order to dance. And so I didn't. I didn't drink at all my first shift. And it is a trip when I think back on that I did that. That is just insane to me. So the first couple days I didn't drink, but I sure made up for it the whole rest of the time that I was there. I will tell you that. And then something really bizarre happened. One evening, I walked into the dressing room during my second week there, and I saw someone from high school. One of my goth club friends from high school apparently ended up being a stripper and was also there in Fairbanks, Alaska during the same random time as myself, someone I hadn't even seen in 4 years. And we were really good friends in high school. As soon as she saw me in the dressing room, she smiled so big. And from then on, she took me under her wing. She really looked out for me. And I really think that she saved my life because I was getting pretty out of control, you know, which is easy to do. I was doing a lot of reckless and insane and a few times life-threatening things. But, you know, it's easy to get out of control when you're not attached to anything. There's just this free-flowing booze everywhere. People are throwing money at you. All of these men think you're amazing. It's really easy to get what we call in the industry stripperitis or platinum pussy syndrome. Fortunately for me, my friend took me aside and gave me a little talk and said, "It's important that you differentiate between Chloe and Alex." As an aside, my stage name was Chloe back then, and my real name is Alex. And yes, it was Chloe because I was a big fan of Mother Love Bone, and they had a song called Chloe Dancer about a stripper in New Orleans. She said, "It's important to always retain Alex. And right now, what I see is Alex going away and you drowning in Chloe." And that always stuck with me, and it humbled me. When I came back from Alaska, I immediately quit my job and I went to work as a stripper in Portland, which was extremely easy to do because Portland has more strip bars per capita than anywhere else in the entire world. That's not a lie. Look it up. I worked at the world-famous Magic Gardens, as well as the world-famous Mary's Club, where Courtney Love was also a dancer. My drinking got pretty intense at this point, because now I worked in a bar. So I became completely desensitized to the alcoholism and the dysfunction around me. I was completely unfazed by the madness of my own life, because I lived in a world where it was normal to be drunk all day. That's what everybody around me was doing. Plus, it was the early 90s, and the grunge music scene in Portland was really taking off. All of my boyfriends were in bands. I went to a lot of shows. I saw a lot of amazing bands before they were anybody. In fact, I'm pretty sure that if the Satyricon were still standing, you would definitely be able to find my ass print permanently etched into one of the bar stools there. And I wouldn't trade that part of my life for anything. Even though I was consistently one drink away from alcohol poisoning. But I had managed to stay away from Crystal for years. Not because of any kind of insight or growth or healing, but because I felt that when I had almost died, that it had been my fault. As if I was being punished for being a drug addict. And since I knew I was lucky to still be alive, I wasn't going to push it. Because then God would kill me. Because I'm a bad person. Because I did drugs. That ridiculous belief made me too afraid to even do one line again. But that thinking was based in superstition. And fear only works as a deterrent for so long. Then one day, somebody at work asked me if I wanted a line. I asked them what it was. They told me it was Crystal. I said, nope, I had a problem with that before. Thank you anyway. And I was so impressed by my ability to say no that a couple weeks later, when somebody asked me the same question, I thought, well, I've already proven to myself that I can quit. I've already proven to myself that I can say no. So this time, I'm just going to have fun, and I'm going to say yes. And I said yes. And within 3 months, I was homeless. I was so strung out on crystal meth that I couldn't even keep my 3 days a week job stripping. And once I lost my ability to work, it was downhill from there. It was shocking to me, the speed at which my life so quickly declined after doing that first line. That was it. I had lost everything. Everything. My car, my belongings, my cat, my apartment, my job, my friends. Once my addiction reached that level, the circle of humans that I moved among had grown increasingly small. Until the only people that I spoke with were people who were strung out like me, whose daily mission was getting money for and getting drugs. In order to make money, I started doing what's called running paper. I would make fake IDs on my computer, make fake checks with stolen account numbers to cash. But what I did daily was I would make fake checks and fake IDs, and then I would go around and I would buy a bunch of stuff at stores with cash return policies. As a quick aside, the policies that were in effect when I was doing this back in the early 90s are no longer in effect. So I feel safe sharing with you what I did without worrying about anybody going to go try to do it themselves. Okay. So I had a list of stores that I knew would give you cash back with a receipt, even if you paid with a check. So Ross, Nordstrom, Office Depot, Macy's, The Gap, Urban Outfitters, they all had this policy. I would go from one store to the next, buying whatever I wanted, and then returning things for cash. So I was constantly shopping, returning, and getting high, and that was my life. I never got busted for all of that paper crime that I did, for the most part, but I did have a pretty intense run-in with the law that ended in some serious charges. There was this guy who thought I was cute and who liked to steal cars. I didn't have a car at the time, And so he gave me one, a stolen car. So I was driving this stolen car with my friend in the passenger side, not the person who stole it, just another person. And I realized that it was Friday night. I was driving down this major road in Portland. We were blasting NWA out of the car, and I thought, this is a really bad idea. And I turned to my friend, and I said, I'm pulling over. Let's ditch the car. I just had a bad feeling. And as soon as I pulled over, a random, weird car pulled up and parked like a T in front of me so that we couldn't move. And all I had time to say was, what the... And I didn't even get that out before the driver's door came flying open. And there was this cop with his gun in my face saying, get the fuck out of the car. And then another person with a gun pulling my friend out, telling her to get the fuck out of the car. They separated us immediately, popped the hood of the car, read the VIN. That was that. I got arrested, obviously. They knew that I did not steal the car. They were looking for the person who had stolen, apparently, a bunch of cars in a certain area. They knew it wasn't me. They just wanted me to tell them who gave me the car, who the person was. But instead, I had this really great story that I told them. I came up with this great story on the fly. I was pretty proud of it, you know? But none of it mattered because I didn't have the keys to the car. I was starting it with a screwdriver. So, as great as my story was, it didn't fly. I was booked and released without any charges because that's how it goes. They have up to a year to create a case against you and then formally charge you. So they booked and released me. But when they booked me, I didn't have an address to give them because I didn't have one. I was living in a $20 a day downtown cockroach-infested hotel called the Century Plaza. So I gave them that address, including the room number that I was staying in, because that was my address at the time. So this cycle, this trap, continued for a while of needing to make enough money to pay for my crappy hotel so I could have somewhere to live, and therefore needing to get high every day so I could go out and do the things I needed to do to make them money so I could pay for my crappy hotel so I could have basic shelter. It was just repeat on repeat. And repeat. There was no end in sight, it seemed. Then one day, with the help of my mother, who worked at the property management company, I rented an apartment with a fake ID. And surprise, surprise, I got caught about a month later. But not before I found out that I was pregnant.
Today's show was produced and edited by Gregory Day and Alex Kennedy. Make sure to tune in to Alex's podcast, The Devil Made Me Do It, for part two of her amazing biography. We'll be featuring more local acts in 2025. Make sure to stay tuned for new episodes. You've been listening to The Portland Podcast.